time, I'd like to call this meeting to order. Let the record reflect, the time is 11:05. The day is Tuesday, March 8, 2005. Let the record show that we have Representative Lynn Wilson, Guerra, Salmon, Gatto, myself, Chair Newman, here today. We do have a quorum. Today we will be hearing in this order HB 128, Alaska School Physical Activity Task Force. Then we'll hear a presentation from Alaska Native K-12 Education Indicator Study presented by Alaska Native Policy Center. Right now, this committee has before us HB 128, Alaska School Physical Activity Task Force. Bill sponsor, Representative McGuire. I believe we have Shalon Szymanski here, along with Representative McGuire, to speak on this. During the last meeting, Representative Guerra and the sponsor noted a possible amendment to this bill. We'll be hearing about that. I guess first possibly would you want to hear the amendment, and then we'll get on. Maybe we can hear from the sponsor a little bit more on this bill.
Sure, Mr. Chair. I'll introduce and move amendment number one, which we distributed. It's the one that starts out at page 4, line 6. And what that does is it just clarifies that the members who serve in the task force won't be paid and won't receive per diem. And that's consistent with our intent of the bill, which is we want people who are committed to working on the issue, and I don't think anybody desires to be paid. And this will also zero out. It'll zero out what is a small from legislative counsel by making clear that there's no per diem. So I'd move amendment number one.
Okay. First, let the record reflect that Representative Thomas is here. We also have in the audience my friend Representative Jewell, Reggie Jewell. If you'd like to come up and sit up front here, that's fine, and McGuire. Just for the sake of a little bit of discussion, maybe I'll object to this amendment so we can talk about it a little bit. Personally, I feel that this is a good amendment. I believe this should be a volunteer task force. Also, my office did contact legal on this. There is some question as to whether how it pertains to this, because it is still an Alaska statute on how committees are paid on this. But I think it's a good presentation by this bill and this committee to say that this is a volunteer situation. And beyond that, if there is any more discussion on this from the members of this committee. Okay, amendment passes.
Mr. Chair,
you have to withdraw your amendment. I withdraw
my objection.
Yeah.
Amendment passes with no objection. If the sponsor of the bill would like to come up and talk about this a little bit, we'd sure like to hear from her.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the Education Committee. Just wanted to stop by today. I've had scheduling conflicts when it's been up in the past, and just thank you for all of the hard work that you've done. And you know, Representative Guerra has been here to speak as one of the co-sponsors of the bill as well, and one of the people who was instrumental in putting all this together. But I think all of us are aware of the epidemic that obesity is becoming in our country, and the saddest part is to watch our young people slip into that, into a lifestyle that is very difficult to get away from in later years, and the costs are there. Whether it's medical, whether it's societal, they're there. And Representative Guerra and I met with many concerned physicians, frankly, in the community over the interim. And we tried to put our fingers around what we could do. And after meeting with Carol Como and others in the school district, we realized that it would be unfair to mandate something that we weren't willing to pay for. And so rather than passing along another unfunded mandate to the schools who are already trying to deal with No Child Left Behind and many other things, we decided that this task force would be the way to go. And so we're looking forward to having the participation of physical education teachers, physicians in the field who have watched over the last decade the percentages of obese children grow, and of course members of this body and the other body to weigh in and see what kinds of things we might be able to do to tackle this. And I also want to say thank you. I know very quietly back there, Dave Parrish has been in the audience. There's a lot of interest you may not have heard of from yet from the Heart Association and others who are really looking to some kind of a solution for this. Thank you for your interest and your hard work.
Yes, Representative Lynn.
You made the comment that this body, another body, should perhaps weigh in with that.
It was a slip.
And also, I wonder if there's any kind of a conflict of interest on this committee in that our chairman has provided all this for us here, Candy.
Bribery.
I mean, would we need this bill if we'd stop doing this kind of stuff? I withdraw the question.
Well, we'll make sure that you don't have any candy.
No.
Representative Gatto, do you have a question?
I don't have a question or comment, Mr. Chair. Actually, things are being done, and while I was sitting on my duck watching television, there was a program, and the title was, I don't know what the title, The Worst City in America, the people that were the most overweight. Anybody else watch that one? I'm the only one, I guess. Guess where it is?
We're not exercising.
Houston. Houston, Texas. And boy, they showed those people know how to eat. And one of the issues was supersizing foods. They looked at calories in a meal and then calories when you supersize it. They have eating contests all the time. It's not a question. It's just that there are people who are at least looking into what to do about it. And, of course, you first identify the worst case and then find out what they do and then maybe consider what they're doing is getting at the root of the problem is to look at what they're doing and maybe undo it. And clearly, they're not getting exercise in Houston, very clearly.
Through the chair, if I might comment, Representative Gatto, you should be commended to your district, actually. There was an article a couple of weeks ago that the Matsu Borough has voluntarily introduced nutritious foods, more nutritious foods into the menu, and that they've had rave reviews from the kids that are eating these foods. And that has been, I know Representative Kapsner is here in the audience too, many members have looked at forcing the schools not to have soda pops or to change the menu to provide more nutritious foods. And those will be some of the topics that I would expect to come up. But I think the case in your district, both from the chair and the vice chair, proves that kids may be more receptive to nutritious food than we know. That's one place to start.
Representative Salmon.
Another good place to start is the capital, too. We need to be good kids in the road.
Take the candy away from you, too.
We got all kinds of pop machines.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For several years, for 9.5 years, I was a school nurse. And just being in the school system and observing the kids, weighing them, taking their, giving them tests for eye tests and ears and things like that, there has been a huge difference in the last 20 years. It is amazing when you look at a group of kids that used to be running around playing ball, not at home sitting in front of a television set, and the lifestyle has changed. And we have, you know, there's definitely a huge difference. And I heard something last night, and it said that doctors are finding now that in very young kids, they're finding high blood pressure, they're finding high cholesterol, and they're finding much more diabetes than they did before. And they are very concerned because they are saying that that we will see soon as these kids get older, that we will see heart attacks and strokes in ages 30 and 40. So this is not something that is going to go away unless we make sure that something is done. So this is a very serious problem, it really is.
Representative Lynn?
You actually brought it up in response to another question. I was very supportive, I think it was last session before, Representative Kapsner's bill on, I believe I co-sponsored that, and I'd like to see that come to life again. But I had people in my office yesterday from the agricultural service, and they were talking about putting dispensers in the schools for healthy foods, mm-hmm. which would be milk and some other thing. And I thought that was rather interesting coming just before we this meeting here, where we get the vending machines with healthy food. And that alone, of course, will not address the problem that you're working with here, but I think it all kind of comes together.
Great suggestion.
Thank you. I'd also like to mention we do have Representative Kapsner here. She's very involved with educational issues throughout the whole state. If she would like to join us or later on their presentation, that certainly welcome. Also, I would like to mention that this bill asks for members of the House of Representatives and the Senate to volunteer to be on this committee. I have spoken to Representative McGuire about this. The sponsor of this bill and volunteered myself as a representative from the House of Representatives to be on this committee. And encourage others to please do so. Do we have any more questions here, Representative Guerra?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When Representative McGuire and I sat down and started talking about this, the more compelling facts are, I mean, it's bad enough that 30 to 40% of the children nationwide are now either overweight or obese, but that age is getting younger, that is happening, and by the time of adulthood, by the time children enter adulthood, that number increases to 70% now. 70% of people entering adulthood are either overweight or obese, and this is part of the solution. Representative McGuire and I talked about the other part, which you have now all talked about, which really was spurred by Representative Kapsner when she did the soda pop and vending machine bill. But another component, which would be great for anybody to decide to work on, it just doesn't really fit in this bill, but another component would be to look at what other states are doing in mandating lower calorie, lower fat, lower sugary meals for kids who right now are eating Taco Bell in school. And that is a whole nother issue that would be, it'd be a great bill by somebody to work on if somebody had the energy. So, but I'm going to ask the oddest question I have ever asked to somebody presenting a bill, but because of Representative McGuire's experience as a chair, the Representative Wilson also has similar experience. Now that we've zeroed out the fiscal note, essentially, I mean, legislative council will zero out the fiscal note. Can we pass this bill out of committee and zero it out ourselves?
Through the chair, the record is what you choose to adopt or not. So when you make the motion to move the bill out, simply indicate that you're moving it with a zeroed fiscal note. If you wanted, your committee aide, Rex, could actually draft a committee fiscal note with a zero in it. There are a couple of different procedural ways of doing it, but yeah. So when you make the motion, make it clear that I think you do. You have a zero fiscal note before you now.
We have zero fiscal notes from everybody except for legislative council. I don't think can zero theirs out until they look at the amendment and then say it's a zero. So it's either we either wait for them to do that or we do it now.
I would just move it without the legislative council fiscal note and then await the arrival of the new legislative council fiscal note in Hess.
I believe so. Representative Thomas.
Yes, thank you. Let me say that Representative Lynn and I were taking offense when Representative Guy was talking about obesity as he got older. We were sitting over here and he was looking at us. We didn't know if he was looking at you at us, but
we volunteered to be exhibit one and two. Yeah.
But my question is now that you've taken the fiscal note off of here, can you create an ad hoc committee to go forward and not wait for this bill to come through, but get your volunteers and get them moving? You already have one. Find the rest of the people who volunteer and instead of waiting for this bill to go through and then just transfer the...
Through the chair, Representative Thomas, we're already kind of rounding up people that have expressed interest. So as the bill moves through through the legislative process, we'll continue to do that. So my preference would be if so willing that you move it out today and get it on to the Hess committee where we could accept the zeroed fiscal note there just to keep it moving. You know, it's always an interesting question about doing task forces. there are a lot of reasons for doing them and a lot of good reasons not to do them. In this case, we weighed in on the side of doing it because we thought a couple of things. First, we thought that it would bring some publicity and some interest in the subject that might not otherwise be there with a group of folks just getting together of their own volition. The second thing that I think it does is, having worked in different groups, both in task forces and out, I think it adds a little bit of structure. And with the mandate of bringing something back, a report back to the legislature, there's sort of this pressure that's placed on the group, appropriate level of pressure to get something done. So we'll continue to round up folks to be on it, but my request would be if you could keep it moving.
Certainly. Representative Wilson?
Are you ready for a motion?
Do we have any more discussion on this? Any more questions? Chair would entertain.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that House Bill 128 moves out of committee with individual recommendations and a zero fiscal note. As amended.
Fiscal note from
amended.
From the Department of Education. Correct. At this time, we will pass this out of committee. No hearing, no objections. Bill passes. We now hear from Sarah Scanlon and Greta Godo, who will present us with an overview of Alaska Native K-12 education indicators. It's a pleasure to talk to these ladies. I know I've had a chance to talk to them a little bit this morning, and I encourage the rest of the committee, if they get a chance, to please try and also talk to them.
Thank you, Chairman Newman, members of the committee. We appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today about research that the Alaska Native Policy Center is doing.
State your name for the record?
My name is Sarah Scanlon, Director of Education at First Alaskans Institute, and this is my colleague.
Greta Godo, Director of the Alaska Native Policy Center at First Alaskans Institute.
Greta heads up the work that we will be presenting this morning, and I will go ahead and start the presentation and would ask, Chair, would you like them to go ahead and ask questions, or do you want to wait till we get done? We have a lot of slides. We're going to go through them very, very quickly.
I believe we can. If the presentation isn't real long, then it is best if we have questions along the way. This is somewhat informal. Just go ahead and chime in, members of the committee, if you have a question, and they'll be glad to answer those.
In your packets that we left for you is the copy of the PowerPoint presentation. First Alaskans Institute mission is to develop the capacities of Alaska's Native people, as shown up there. We are involved in research through the Alaska Native Policy Center. Our mission is to share that information and to ensure that policy, as it's being developed or has been developed, is changed accordingly, shown by the data from our research. We have done several reports that we'll speak to as we go through this presentation. We are a 501c3, governed by former chairs and current chairs and presidents of the AFN. Today we will cover these two primary areas. We will give you an overview of our choices and the K-12 reports, both done in the last year. We will cover very quickly the connections between population, health, economy, and education, and then we'll speak with you and share with you the feedback that we've received from the many presentations that we have done already around the state. Before Greta starts, I'll just talk to you about the importance of understanding that as we were doing and beginning the steps to do the research that we're going to share with you, we wanted to make sure that we didn't look at demographics, health, education, and the economy as separate silos, but rather to understand that the four areas and others too are intricately connected, and that in looking at one or the other piece, that it was important to remember how they impact each other. We have done the data to understand where we've made some improvements, and more importantly, what work still remains, not just for Alaska Native people, but in general across the state.
Thanks, sir. Chairman Newman, what we're going to be doing is going through four sections of a report that was titled Our Choices, Our Future. This was an analysis that the Alaska Native Policy Center did of a report that ICER, the Institute of Social and Economic Research, did for the Alaska Federation of Natives. That report looks at 30 years of information on Alaska Native population, health, economics, and education. So we're going to go through those sections fairly quickly and then spend a little bit more time on the education piece. What you'll see once we get through the population section is that the Alaska Native population is growing. We're a very young population. Our life expectancy has increased. The majority of our population still lives in rural and remote Alaska. We're very mobile, and there are changing family structures. What you see here very quickly over a 40-year period of time, 1960 to 2000, and this information is coming from the census data, the population of Alaska Natives was about 120,000 in the year 2000. ICER forecast that our population would grow to about 165,000 in the year 2020.
Can I ask, is that the same acceleration or velocity as the population in general?
Our birth rates are a little bit higher. Alaska Native birth rates are a little bit higher. So given that and the increasing life expectancies, those numbers of the total population would be increasing. What we see here is just a breakout very quickly of the 12 regions that were created under the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. Our report, the Our Choices, Our Future, as well as the Alaska Native K-12 Education Indicators reports are broken out in these specific regions so that our people can see this information in a format that is easily understandable.
I believe we had a question from Representative Thomas.
Yes, can you define Alaska Native? I know it's changed several times, and so.
In this report, ICER defined Alaska Native as Alaska Natives that are either 100% Alaska Native or mixed race, and the Alaskan or American Indians population is also included in that number. And there are about 10,000, I believe that number was in 2000. They mainly live in the Anchorage and Fairbanks areas. And it is based on the census information, and people self-select what their race might be.
But under the Claims Act, you have descended up also, and that gets below the, used to be the quantum level quarter.
Right, that isn't taken into consideration here.
It goes down to, do you have any blood at all?
Yes, okay. And again, it's self-selected. So if, for example, when I choose on the census mark, if I'm Alaska Native, or I think I'm Alaska Native, I check that mark.
I mark both. I'm half and half. I mark both and confuse them.
So continuing on, this slide here just shows the percentage of the Native population in each of our regions. The total Alaska population, again, about 19% of the population is Alaska Native. Compare that to regions like Nana and Chulistu, where the majority of the population is comprised of Alaska Natives. This next slide, we're looking at an age distribution of the Native and non-Native population compared to each other. And what's really noticeable here is those numbers of the ages 19 and below. This is where I was saying the Alaska Native population is quite young. About 44% of our population is 19 years of age or younger, compared to about 33% of the non-Native population. We also have a growing elders population. It's expected by the year 2020 about 13,000 of the Alaska Natives will be in that age group of 65 and older.
Greta, do you feel that maybe those populations represent a little bit on better medical conditions for the Native population?
Yes, the life expectancy, one of the reasons why it's increased is due to increased access to health care.
Good.
Yes, and that's coming up. What we're seeing here in this slide is the trend of living arrangements for Alaska Native children from 1960 to 2000. And I think what's noticeable here is that there's been an increase in the number and share of Alaska Native children that are living in households headed by a single person. That purple there is families headed by a woman, and the kind of squiggly mark is families that are headed by males. This is not anything unusual compared to the total population. We're seeing the similar kinds of things in the total population as well. Sarah?
We want to just share with you some of the feedback that we've received as we've gone around the state to present this information, and just let you know that some of the main concerns that folks have are what's going to happen if the projections continue as they are for the growing numbers of kids in school. How are we going to address the issues of funding? How are we going to address the issues of the growing elder numbers? As Greta mentioned, we'll have 13,000 projected in 2020, and right now there are about 6,300, so we will more than double that elder population in a short period of time. Workforce development and placement are issues that are of concern to the folks out there, health and social service provisions. And then additionally, folks wanted to let us know that they appreciate this data so that they can use it for planning purposes, for determining what programs need attention, for prioritizing what needs to be done at the local levels. So we will continue to do this kind of data collection as it seems to be making quite a difference for folks.
So moving on to the health section, what you'll see here is that there have been some positive gains, some very good positive gains in health for Alaska Natives, and there are continuing and some new challenges. Again, the life expectancy, in 1950, the life expectancy for Alaska Natives was about 46 years of age compared to all other races at 68 years of age. That has increased to 70 years by 1997. So some tremendous gains in there. And again, Chairman Newman, that is somewhat quite a bit attributed to the increased access to health care. Immunizations, this is some other good news that we are very pleased to be able to report. Native children are generally better immunized than other American children. The outbreaks of measles among Native children and adults have been cut sharply. Hepatitis A and B have been sharply reduced. Another good piece of news, but this kind of has a good news, bad news scenario. The infant mortality rates for Alaska Native infants has tremendously decreased over the last 50 years or so. But there's still a disparity between Alaska Natives and all other Americans. And you'll notice that some of these comparisons are between all other Americans, whites, or all other Alaskans. And that's partly in due to the fact of how the data is collected. This speaks directly to what you were just talking about a little bit earlier, obesity. What we see here is a trend between 1991 and about 2001 of rates of obesity for Alaska adults, and we can see that the Alaska Native rate has really increased and is higher than the non-Native rate between the years of 1999 and 2001. And there are several programs that are being put into place by some of our healthcare systems. So again, like as you were mentioning, this is an issue that people are addressing.
Say, Greta?
Yes, sir.
I noticed that on this last slide, it says where Alaska adults who are obese, you know, the Native and non-Native, they tend to go upward, but yet the health care is increased greatly, which that's a great thing. Do you have any idea how those two correlate?
We're not really sure if there is a correlation. There may be a relationship, and I don't think it's necessarily related to the health care industry. When we asked people about this out in the regions, their comments were there's been some changes in dietary patterns. You know, pop in schools is one of those things. And I think it's something that you see every day, but you don't really notice it until you see some hard numbers like this. And a lot of the effort that we've been taking out to the regions with this is showing the data, showing what the numbers are showing. And it's really a creating of awareness and knowledge development about these issues. And I think once we are able to go back out again and talking with folks, they're going to have some better ideas of what and why these numbers are increasing.
Certainly outreach programs like this are a huge part of what you're doing to make sure that everybody knows exactly what's going on. I commend you for that.
Thank you. The rates of diabetes is one of or obesity is one of the risk factors for diabetes, and those rates have really increased for our Native people. Between 1985 and 1999, the rate of diabetes among Alaska Natives had doubled. Our rates of smoking are higher than non-Natives, and that seems to be a continuing trend over the last 10, 15 years. This next slide, we're looking at fetal alcohol spectrum disorder rates. These numbers are the numbers of cases per 1,000 births of children that have been diagnosed with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, or FAS. These numbers, when we took this information out to the regions, many folks were saying that they thought these numbers might be too low. And you notice there's kind of a jump between 1989, 92 to 1995 and 99. And part of the reason for that is because of a grant that the state had received from the federal government to work with three or four other states in a program to better help identify what some of the FASD rates might be in each of those states. So we've got better information, and there's more of an effort on trying to identify children who may be afflicted with FASD.
Got a question for you.
Yes, sir.
Does the presence of dry communities, do you track them separately for FAS, or has the existence of dry communities made a difference in the rates?
I can't answer that question specifically because this data is compiled from the Department of Health and Social Services, and that they're getting their information through the IHS system, Indian Health Service system, and a lot of that information then gets combined, and I don't think that they break out necessarily which community that it's coming from. Yeah.
Greta, and again, I just ask committee members, if you do have a question, just chime right in here for the sake of time. And again, this is Sarah and Greta, so you can direct your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Greta, it's a very similar question. The answer might be the same. I know you don't have it broken down between dry communities and non-dry communities, but I'm curious more generally, do we know whether it's a bigger problem in urban Alaska or rural Alaska?
I can't answer that question, and we will find out and get back to you. Teen health, similar types of issues here. There have been improvements in the situation, but there's still disparities. And what you're seeing here are birth rates for Alaska Native and white teenage girls ages 15 to 19. The disparity there, again, the rates are coming down, but there is still a disparity. Students who smoke, and this is taken from information data from between 1995 and 2003. Again, some good news is that both the rates for Alaska Natives and non-Natives has gone down, but there's still a disparity in the number of Native students who are smoking.
And Greta, do you have any idea why those numbers reflect that? Does it have to do with maybe the funding that's going for education on smoking? Or why is there such a disparity there, do you think?
That's a good question, and we're going to have to get back with you on that one as well. The only thing that I can say is that there seems to be a relationship here to the adults that are smoking. There are higher rates of Native men and women that are smoking than non-Native men and women, and it may be having something to do with being a role model, but I don't know that for sure. That's my
smoking in the
opinion.
Home does matter.
I would think so.
I believe it was only last session we passed an increase in taxes on cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a gut feeling if smoking is deterred at all by the increased price?
It hasn't stopped my husband.
Yeah, but he has your salary.
No.
How about kids that, you know, are not getting it?
Yeah, when I was out in Yakutat for the students' OSOG meeting last year, I asked them a ton of questions about the reality things about what really mm-hmm. is going on, and they didn't seem to think that was necessarily going to stop, but we hope that the data will show otherwise. Mm-hmm. So you have to be measured that'll be measured for the coming year.
Mm-hmm. These next three slides are looking at harder drug and alcohol use. Marijuana use has gone up in usage for Alaska Native students from 1995 to 2000, and this is based on the Alaska Youth Risk Behavior Survey that is conducted by the Department of Education and Health and Social Services.
Greta, do you know what in the non-Native population has happened with that? Do you know?
That one, I think it went down, and I'll have to check. If I have it here or not, Bergson and Wilson, but I believe that these numbers were pretty parallel to the non-Native population as well, but I'll double check on that too and get back with you on that.
I hate to be a nuisance, but you've got the same data in two separate colors, like the colors must mean something, but I don't get...
Two different years.
Well, it's 1995, it was 29%, in 2000 mm-hmm. it was 36%. It's the same... or not the same group?
It may not be the same group, but it's those students that are, the mm-hmm. survey is taken at the time when students are in that particular age range. So the usage in that particular age range has apparently increased according to this data. Move on.
Go ahead.
Binge drinking. This number has gone down over the last 5 years between 1995 and 2000. Some of the other health topics in the Our Choices, Our Future report include improvements in sanitation, healthcare, and housing, death rates, Alaska Native suicide rates, alcohol control, and some of the information on the dry communities is in the report as well. And if you want even more detail, you can go directly to the ICER report, which has this in even more detail.
Greta, we hear a lot about, you have a thing here on binge drinking, but we hear a lot about inhalants and other type of problems that can go on in Bush, Alaska. Does these studies pretty much follow along those lines, too, on the effects of those types of problems?
Yes, and actually, when we took this information out to the regions, that was one of the pieces of data that they want to see and was not necessarily included in the ICER report. And so you'll see when we, this is what the report looked like, and each of you members of the House and Senate received a copy of this. We included a lot of the feedback that our people gave regarding the data that they saw and the things that they wanted to see more of. Some of the things that weren't covered in the ICER report included HIV, for example, and those types of information are things that our people wanted to know and see and be able to understand, because again, it goes back to planning and resource allocation.
Thank you.
Greta, I have one question too. Now, and I can't remember if that slide was up there, but in our packet, you've got birth rates versus non-native and native, and even though the trend is about the same, it's quite a lot more. And I was thinking, well, maybe trying to look at the different slides to see if I could see a correlation with something. And the only thing that really went up, other than that, was the marijuana use. Mm-hmm. Everything else is kind of slowing down, and I don't know if there's a correlation there or not.
I don't think we can say that there's a correlation.
But I mean, you know, well, I mean, you might do activities that you normally wouldn't do. I mean, yeah, mm-hmm. under the influence of alcohol and drugs and various things. So I'm just trying to figure out if you guys have come up with any kind of correlation at all.
Not between those two specific items, no.
Would you say as the price of tobacco goes up, the ability, well, the opportunity to switch to a different drug as marijuana would then simply shift over? Tobacco use goes down, marijuana use goes up. I just wondered if I guess what I'm asking is, do you observe these things, or are you just giving us the chart, or are you active in compiling statistics?
ICER compiled the statistics. We took them all out to our regions to over 20 presentations, formal presentations, where we spoke directly with 1,400 people, and many of these presentations were broadcast over several radio stations and also webcast. And the information that we got here, we worked very closely with ICER as they were compiling this information.
That's good.
So that they could understand what our people would want to see, and also that we could help them better identify their graphs so that they'd be easy to understand.
So in your, Greta, in your observations from talking to over 1,400 people in this, are some of those opinions and ideas reflected in this information?
Yes.
Great. So it shows a really wide range. Different areas of the state.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Go
and
ahead, Sarah.
If I could add Representative Goddard's question. Many of the questions that you're asking are issues that were sort of touched on the periphery but not mm-hmm. dealt with directly. And so while we have our personal opinions about things that you're asking about, we're trying to report the data and the feedback that we got mm-hmm. from communities as we've heard them. But many of the questions, too, that you're asking are not questions that came up directly, although peripherally things were touched upon.
Well, when I see data like this, I think, you know, what's the action plan?
Yes.
And then I ask you for your personal feelings, because I see the data, but sometimes your gut feeling can overwhelm the data, and you say, listen, I've been around this a lot.
Yeah.
For instance, if you talk to the nurse in the community or the public health worker in the community, they'll give you data that, you know, they can get that quickly and tell you how significant a problem is.
Yes.
And that's why I asked.
Mm-hmm. And again, if I might, Mr. Chairman, Representative Gatto, this effort, again, has been a knowledge development effort. We haven't seen data like this in the Native community for over 15 years when the first ICER report was done on the status of Alaska Natives. And it's really been an effort. I have to give a lot of credit to AFN and to First Alaskans for really pushing to have this information available. It's been the first time, again, in about 15 years where we've had a real comprehensive overview as to what the Alaska Native population is looking like.
Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sarah, Greta, either of you, if you know, I'm curious. We had debates in the House on education funding recently, and one of the pieces of knowledge I learned, which I didn't have before, was how in many of the communities in the state, how limited the curriculum is, given teacher staffing problems and things like that. And I'm wondering, on let's say the two examples that we saw of FAS, the very high rate of FAS, and let's say the high rate of smoking. I assume in some schools those issues are addressed maybe in a health class, but is there any sort of statewide requirement that people get educated on issues like this? And so that's a shaking your head no. And then would that be useful at all?
Absolutely. In fact, when we get to the education piece here, we will speak to some of the very specific areas where the needs have been identified to us for improving these health and these economic and these career awareness and these job preparedness stuff that is not currently going on that needs to be. And it goes back to this issue too. One thing we did hear repeatedly was these numbers are too low. The numbers that you've reproduced for us from the ICER data are too low. They aren't. People would tell us, for example, FASD, that the health nurses and the health aides, for example, in the communities and in the schools anecdotally told us that there really are more kids with FAS than what the data is showing. So we heard a lot of that the data does not accurately reflect really what is going on out there. But it's the best we have right now, and it's our start to have a benchmark to begin measuring what progress is being made over time as programs and plans are developed at the local communities to address them. And really, as Greta mentioned, this is the first time that there is data where people can put their thumbs on something and say, this is a priority, we must begin working on it. So in many respects, this is a start, and really appreciate the questions that you're raising because they add to the group of questions that have already been asked at the local levels.
And that's where I think House bills like HB 128 that has just gone through this committee help to try and recognize and bring some of this information together so we can start addressing these in a better fashion. Representative Garrett?
Just briefly, and maybe it's in your presentation, sometimes I'm like way too blunt with my ideas and you know, they turn out to be dumb. But it seems to me that, I mean, on some of the great public health concerns, like some of the ones that you've presented, that those are things you could teach, even if you didn't have a teacher who dedicated a whole semester to something like that. Those things could be taught everywhere without great difficulty. Am I missing something? It's not that easy, I would guess.
That is a loaded question for a number of reasons. Let's take FASD, for example. We are hearing, and you will all hear when the Rural Justice Commission begins putting their information out that they've collected in the last several weeks, that kids and students and young people are coming to them about issues of parents learning and knowing. And this is a awareness creation exercise for us too, is creating the awareness of the issues that are going on out there that really have been talked about, but not in a very focused, direct way about what has to happen in order to begin fixing each of these specific problems. There have been wellness programs out there, many working very, very well and doing good things out there. We see the results in things like infant mortality, those kinds of things, teenage smoking, those kinds of things that are succeeding. How do we grow on those successes and begin getting at the other issues that seems like when we plug one hole, another one opens up? So when individuals in the communities, and we see this happening all over the state, take on the role of being the role model or the teacher or the person that takes on an issue that they feel needs to be addressed, we all know that as individuals it's up to us to make that difference as families and parents and communities. So that's the message that we're getting out that's already been out there for many years. Some of this stuff is so overwhelming when we get down to the issues of what is a healthy community, what is the makeup of a healthy community. And I think for too long we have looked at it through government programs that are siloed and have not really
connected all the pieces to begin the holistic approach to what makes a healthy community and how we get folks as individuals and families involved in the process. That's the kind of thing that we're hearing from folks and that we are working on to get away from that siloed approach and rather break it down so that there's a community approach to wellness. And it's not just about wellness in the way that we think about it, it's wellness in spirituality, holistic health, education, economics, that kind of wellness.
Go ahead, Representative Wilson.
Thank you. I want to make a comment, too, because Alaska, we're such a new state, and we can look at some other states and learn from their experience. And my own experience as a school nurse, I'm thinking mid-80s to mid-90s. During that time, I was a school nurse, and I went into all the classrooms in all, this is a school of 4,000 kids, the school district. But I did drug and alcohol prevention programs. I went into each classroom many, many times and actually had a program that this week I taught this, the next week I taught this, and I went into over 20 classrooms many, many times, you know. And this was at grades 1, 2, and 3. And in North Carolina at that time, the legislature mandated that there had to be a school nurse for ever so many kids. And, you know, we just don't do things in Alaska, and we don't fund things that other states do and don't even think anything of it. And so I think we've got a long ways to go as a state.
Yes.
What do we think is normal to teach in a school, and you know, most of our schools don't even have a school nurse. And when you only have one or two teachers in a school, they have to cover everything. It's very difficult to do that. So I mean, I think we've got a long ways to go as in our education system.
And if I could, Mr. Chairman, one of the things that we have heard loud and clear is the need for early childhood education that will begin to get to this issue of parental involvement with raising healthy kids and communities. So, and our state does not have an early childhood education program.
Thank you, Greta. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, moving on to economics, we wanted to just pull out some data here and really show that there is, I think we'll see a relationship between economics and education. What we know from some of the data is that about 17% of the state's workforce, and this is defined as people ages 16 and older, are Alaska Natives. 33% of the unemployed Alaskans, when this report was put together, were Alaska Natives. And many of the Alaskans with work experience in 2000, Alaska Natives were the most heavily represented labor, service, clerical, and operative and craft occupations. And there is somewhat of a correlation there, or relationship, I should say, between that and household income. What we see here is a slide that represents the average household income for Alaska Native regions, comparing the statewide number to the statewide average household income for non-natives, which is $60,000 over here on the left-hand side. Statewide, the native household income was about $43,000 in the year 2000. And then in each of the regions, you can see what the average household income was there. And that corresponds to the rates of poverty by region. Statewide, the non-native rate of poverty was about 7% in 1999-2000. And for Alaska Natives, that rate was 20%. And each of our regions, again, it is either higher or a little bit lower in terms of rates of poverty. Cost of food, you can see some of the expenses that people are paying out in our rural communities. This is just a slide looking at Bethel and comparing it to Anchorage. And this information comes from the food cost survey that the University of Alaska in Fairbanks does. The rate of food in Bethel is about 187% of what it costs in Anchorage. And this number, as you can see, it's a trend, and the disparity there hasn't really gone down over the years, and it seems to be increasing. PCE costs, our electric costs, just a sample of some of the information that's available, and this comes directly from the statistical report that the PCE program puts together through the Energy Authority. These communities are in the Chulister region. The PCE rate is that rate in blue, which is contributing to the cost of electricity, and then the cost is that the household is paying is 80 cents, I mean, in the purple. So, for example, in Lime Village, the total cost of electricity would be 80 cents, and the resident is paying about, is it 45 cents per kilowatt hour, compared to Anchorage, where we're paying about 11 cents per kilowatt hour.
I take it that meant the first 350 kilowatts?
No, this is in terms of cents. That yellow is what the PCE program was contributing in the FY year, fiscal year 2003. And we just got the new numbers from AEA there, and so I can't tell you what the percentage or the what the PCE program was paying for this.
Does PCE bring the rate down to the 11 cents?
No.
Is that what it does?
No,
so
no,
what does
no, no.
PCE do?
PCE, the total cost, for example, in Lime Village, the total cost of electricity is 80 cents. The PCE is subsidizing that at a rate of 35 cents per kilowatt hour, so the household is paying 45 cents per kilowatt hour.
Right. And he was asking about the Anchorage rate.
The Anchorage doesn't have PCE. In terms of business, Alaska Natives own about 11% of all the business firms in Alaska. They generate about 5% of Alaska's total business revenue. The ANGSA regional and village corporations have a large role in the Alaska economy, generating about almost $3 billion in annual revenues and employing 13,000 people. The Native nonprofit and for-profit corporations are some of the largest employers in the state. And something that I think is rather interesting is that many of these, particularly the for-profit corporations, have investments outside the state and bring those dollars back into Alaska.
And also I'd like to just add, I think, just a little bit of my opinion on the employment in the business section of this, particularly the employment where 33% of unemployed Alaskans are Alaska Natives. I think that shows a need, particularly for an outreach towards rural Alaska. I think programs, there's several bills through the process right now for regional learning centers and the need for these to try and make sure that we have vocational programs so we can put Alaskans to work for Alaskans' jobs. Go ahead.
Thank you. We've covered the items on here, and we'll cover them a little bit more as we get into the education issues coming up.
Also, we have Representative Coghill in the audience here today.
Now, this last section is on education, and some of this information is coming from the Our Choices, Our Future report, and then the balance of it, though, is coming from the Alaska Native K-12 Education Indicators report. This is a report that we have commissioned McDowell Group to conduct for us. I think what you'll see is that the data shows that we have improved access to education, but there's an academic achievement gap, and there are some things and actions that are required, that will be required to close that gap. What you're seeing here is the number of high schools in each of our regions. The numbers have increased from 1974 to 2003. This is the improved access to education that I just mentioned. For example, in the Bristol Bay region, there were three high schools in the area now, or as of 2 years ago anyway, there were 22 high schools. And one of the reasons for that that you see in here is because of increased access to high schools, the numbers of Alaska Natives over 18 that have completed high school has dramatically increased from 1960, where about 1,700 Alaska Natives reported having high school diplomas, compared to nearly 53,000 in the year 2000. And again, this comes from the census information, and you're self-selecting your answer here. Similar increases in degrees of four-year degrees of college or more, those numbers have really increased. What you see here is the percentage of Native men and women that are attending high school or attending college at one single point in time. So these are not the same people. On the left-hand side, attending high school, about 52% of males are attending high school. 48% were women at this particular point in time. At the same point in time, Alaska Natives attending college, 42% were male, compared to 58% being female. And some of this information has a relationship to income levels and more women, Alaska Native women, being in the workforce.
And Greta, on the slide before that, it shows how many people have actually completed college. I think there's certainly something pretty interesting there is how many people actually start and actually complete. We need to work on that.
Yes. I'm not going to read through this whole thing. I think the most important point is that Alaska Natives do place a high value on education. This information is coming from two surveys that were conducted for First Alaskans Institute by the McDowell Group over two different time periods. While we value education, we're pretty concerned about the performance of our schools. When the question was asked, how well do you think Alaska schools are preparing Native students for high school or college or the workplace or life in your community, the majority of the answers were not well or not very well at all. And we didn't want to just leave it there. We wanted to know who our people thought was most responsible for dealing with the issues facing Native education. And the majority of the answers were the school districts, the school boards, parents, and then state government.
I'm glad to see state governments at the bottom there.
This information now is coming from our report, which is going to be formally released here in the next couple of weeks. What you're seeing here is the public school enrollment for the last school year, so the 2003-2004 school year, and we're looking at the percentage of Native students in each of the regions. So for example, that top bar, about 32,000 students out of the total public school enrollment for the last school year were Alaska Natives, about 24%. And then you can see by each of the regions how many Alaska Native students there are or were in that particular school year in that region. The Chulista region, about 95% of the student population enrolled in public school was Alaska Native, compared to Cook Inlet at about 11%. But the numbers, and it's very important, people wanted to see the numbers too, not just the percentages. The numbers in the Cook Inlet region of Alaska Native students were, in this school year, 8,000, a little over 8,000. The Cook Inlet region includes the Anchorage School District, the Kenai School District, and the Mat-Su School District. In our report, we also look at educators in Alaska by ethnicity, and compared to the previous school year, the numbers haven't really changed a whole lot. In the 2003-2000 school year, on the far left hand, the total percent of superintendents, principals, and teachers within this workforce was close to 5%.
Greta, do you think that, going back to that last slide, do you think that, you know, I've heard in many areas where we're really having, there are students out there trying to get their degree so that they can teach. I mean, I think that probably in the next couple of years we'll see a change in that because they'll be graduating. Do you know?
We hope so.
Yeah, the down here in Juneau, they run the, at UAS, they run the, it's called the PEACHES program, Preparing Indigenous Teachers for Alaska Schools. They by far have the largest numbers of Alaska Natives in an ed track and hope to graduate. Well, there's 30-some students in the program right now, so UAA and UAS are increasing their effort through some recruitment programs that really had not been done collaboratively between the MAUs over the years. So we do expect to see some increases. And we as the Native community, too, have been talking about what do we need to be doing to increase those.
Representative Guerra.
Sarah, maybe Peggy, I'm curious about this. What campuses are we teaching, are we providing educational degrees at this point? The UAS is, and certainly UA and UAS, but are we also?
APU, Sheldon Jackson, and distance delivery through the, what do they call them? Campuses out there, not
the community campuses.
Rural. You get a full teaching degree from a community campus?
You have to come in for what year is it? The fourth year, I believe, but you can take the prep classes through distance delivery and then come in for the, as I understand, the last year.
Continuing on, this next slide, we're looking at educator turnover in Alaska by each of our regions, and then the statewide total is at the very bottom. We defined, when we did this study with McDowell, we defined educator turnover from the standpoint of the student and what the effect of a teacher leaving that classroom or the school, or a change in principalship or a change in superintendent might have on the school and particularly the student. So looking at it from that standpoint, these are the numbers that, we came up with based on data coming from the Department of Education. Bering Straits region has had a teacher turnover rate of about 45%. In Bristol Bay, the superintendent turnover rate was about 70%. This is between 2 years, and there were some. There are some things that are going on in between those 2 years. But in our report, we break these down by school district and even to the level of the school, so you can see what the turnover rates are for each of the school districts, and some of them are quite a bit higher than what the averages are. So it bears for those of you who might be interested in looking at that to take a closer look at some of those turnover rates.
Greta, does it make a difference how remote the area is? The further away from Anchorage you get, going west especially, west or north?
I don't think so. That you can't tell it from here, but the, because like at Chugach. It depends on this. Yeah. I would have to say, Representative Wilson, that it depends more upon looking at the school district. You'd have to look at it district by district and even school by school. I don't think we could generalize very specifically right there. What we're looking at here are the number of schools making and not making AYP by a Native region. Statewide, about 292 of the schools made AYP, and that's an increase of 86 schools from the previous school year. This is the slide that we really wanted to call your attention to that Sarah was talking about a little bit earlier. We're looking at statewide school benchmarks exams, and again, this is at statewide level, comparing Alaska Native students to all other students. And what we see here in general is about a 30% difference in performance of the numbers of students that are performing at the level to be considered proficient. So for example, at grade 3, the reading test score, Alaska Native students, about 51% of them passed the exams, and 81% of all other students were passing those exams. And something that we saw in last year's report and seems to be continuing here is that for all students, the math scores are higher at grade 3 and seem to go down. The testing goes down at grade 6 and grade 8. So that's just a question that's kind of out there, and in my mind at least, you know, what's going on with some of that.
Greta, do you have any correlation how NCLB affects these grades?
We're just saying anecdotally we do, and we can let Sarah comment on that.
Well, when is the dropout and graduation?
Yes,
why
we can
take
that.
Those and we'll answer your question.
Okay, good.
Sure. Yeah.
Representative Salmon, did you have a question?
Yes, the question I had is, we know this, do you have any cause for this problem on this chart here? The difference between the, I mean, what could be causing that?
There are many, many, many reasons. And when we began looking at what is causing this discrepancy and this achievement gap, it's about a 30% achievement gap between not Alaska's Native students and all other students. We know that there is no one reason, but there are any number of reasons. Funding is an issue. Teacher turnover is an issue. Lack of curriculum is an issue. Parental involvement and understanding the value and importance of education is an issue. Lack of early childhood education and pre-prep K-3 for reading and literacy and language development is an issue. Teacher professional development across the board and adequacy of professional development and school boards setting goals about what they want children to know and be able to do consistently across the board and measuring and evaluating and making administrators accountable is an issue. So there's any number of issues, but when you start putting them all together to try to determine at the local levels what are the solutions and what are the issues, they will vary somewhat, but generally there are 6 or 7 drivers that are causing our kids not to do as well as
other students. In addition, we have a huge mobility issue of kids from the bush, from rural Alaska into urban Alaska, and then once they get to the cities, moving and hopping from school to school, creating huge problems for them academically, and it's a huge issue in Anchorage, for example. There are 1,800 homeless kids in the Anchorage School District, and a third of them are Native kids. So those kinds of things begin adding up. But a number of issues, and it depends on the community, but generally there are about six or seven things that we can nail down that are causing this kind of a gap. And I'll be happy again to summarize those at the end here.
Representative Guerra.
I'll just note for the committee, the numbers are not that different for if you just measure people not by anything cultural, but you measure people by income level.
Yes.
Benchmark exam failure is about 50% for low-income Alaskans, regardless of culture.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Guerra, that's exactly right, and that's something that you don't really get to see based on the data, how we presented it here. But if you go back to the poverty levels in the earlier portion of the slides, you would be able to see that there is some sort of relationship there. And certainly at the national level and statewide here, those numbers really do bear out. And I think that's one good thing about No Child Left Behind, is that we've been able to now get this kind of information broken out in those ways that we can kind of see and better understand where some of the issues might be. On the statewide high school graduation qualifying exams, similar type of numbers in terms of achievement, about a 30% achievement gap between Alaska Natives and all other students. What we were just talking about, the dropout rates, this particular piece of information was compiled by ICER for the Choices Report, and it's a trend looking at the dropout rates comparing Alaska Natives to non-Native students. And up until about 1998, the trend for both groups was downward, and then in 1998, the trend kind of goes up. And there's still a disparity here between Alaska Native students and all other students. In our K-12 report, we're looking at this as well. And for the last school year, 2003-2004, the dropout rate for Alaska Native students is about 7.8% compared to all other students at 3.9%. And when we looked at this compared to two school years ago, the 2001-2002 school year, it looks like there may be a slight downward trend in this, but we're not entirely sure yet because there's just not enough data there. But the issue here is, I think, is more than just the percentages, it's the numbers. And it's 1,106 of Alaska Natives that have dropped out of high school, and we don't know where they are and what they're doing. Similarly, 1,874 students of all other ethnicities have dropped out. Where are they? What are we doing to get them back into the system so that they can be contributing members to our communities? This next slide, we're looking at high school graduation rates. The slide that you just saw is a dropout rate, and it's looking at grades 7 through 12 for one school year. This rate here, it probably is the more important one in terms of trying to understand how many students are completing high school. What we are looking at here is how many students entered in ninth grade and how many of them actually completed with a degree at the end of the 12th grade. The graduation rate then for Alaska Natives, based on that definition, which comes from the Department of Education, is 47.5%, compared to all other ethnicities at 67.3%. So Alaska Natives are graduating at a rate of 47%, less than half of our kids who start in ninth grade complete, and over half, 67% of all other students, when they start, they complete. So again, there's something going on within the system, it seems, that is contributing to these numbers.
Greta, I have a question. What are the expectations? I mean, for families? I mean, some families want to maybe just have a subsistence lifestyle, and so is there an expectation that, well, I don't have to graduate to do that? Or are you finding any correlation to what the expectations of the family are, or is am I wrong in that assumption? You know.
When we asked the question out there about what is going on, why is this happening, why are less than half of our kids graduating from high school. It get for the teenage kids, especially for the high school kids, for their answer generally was, we don't see the relevance in what's being taught to us. Rote memorization, those kinds of math things that kids just couldn't connect to, they didn't see in their communities employment opportunities, some of the questions or the issues that Representative Newman brought up about vocational education, career pathways, spending more time in those areas so that kids could see the value of education, how we value education and how we send that message out consistently across the boards were an issue. But in general, when talking to the high school kids about this, they just felt like the hopes for what they could and would be doing in their communities were very limited, and what was being offered in their classrooms is very limited in terms of how we get them to the point of passing the high school qualifying exam, for example. There aren't the teachers up there to do the math parts. The early learning piece for reading and literacy, all of those pieces, the pieces of identifying individuals who need special help, the resources needed to ensure that those kids are on a path and receive the tutoring and whatever help. Those kinds of things aren't available for these kids. And then nailed on top of that was the high school qualifying exam. Now, you all know that students have can take it up to five times in high school. And the feeling, it goes back to your question of what impact has No Child Left Behind had on this. While our data hasn't, we don't have enough years yet to show what happens when kids take the test and don't pass it the first time. Do they drop off? We don't have the data yet, but we are watching that. Anecdotally, the high school students have told us this is what is causing at least some of those students to drop off. Is if they don't pass that test and don't feel like, because they don't have the resources and the math tutoring and the classes that will allow them to pass it, there's no reason to stay in because they're going to just get that certificate of attendance anyway. So it's a whole combination of things, and it really for us points down to some very specific things that we will get to here at the very end of the slideshow about the issues and what needs to be done about them. No silver bullet and no one answer.
I think the most striking statistic that I see is the graduation rate here. 47% and 67% even for non-natives is the fact that through that 6th through 8th grade, so many 90-some percent of the students realize that higher education is important for them. Where are we losing it along the lines there? Where are these kids dropping through the cracks? I think that's where we need to try and start focusing what we can on education, is to pick these kids up, find out where the differences is, or is it just a program curriculum that we have out there? Do we have to change that? Where do we need to look to change this? Obviously, there's something wrong going on here we need to look at. Go ahead. Well, Representative Wilson.
I'm just wondering, because I know in some areas they don't have a Head Start, and that kind of prepares them a little bit for a jump start that they might need before they hit school. And how many of those areas, do you know what the percentage of is, how many areas have Head Start and how many don't?
Do you remember what those numbers are? Communities? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, we were just talking, I believe that Rural Cap coordinates a number of the Head Start programs, and then a lot of the nonprofits also coordinate Head Start programs out in the regions. The last number I seem to recall is somewhere in the neighborhood of 100 communities that had it, but I could be wrong.
Out of
200 plus communities out in rural Alaska.
So like 50% don't have it then.
Mm-hmm. Right, and there's statistics that do show the advantages of Head Start programs, where these, if you can catch these kids even at 3-4 years old, mm-hmm. and start increasing the amount of words they hear, and their graduation rate as to their employment beyond, through their whole livelihood, greatly increases by making sure that we get these kids at a young age and start introducing them to these benefits.
And there, Mr. Chairman, there are some programs, for example, through the Native Medical Service Center in Anchorage, where they have books for babies, and there, I think Providence does that as well, and I believe even Regional Hospital does it. So there are things like that going on, but again, it doesn't necessarily reach everybody. So, but your point is very well taken. I think that sooner.
Maybe you could provide that information to the members of this committee so that when we are talking to folks, we can help spread the word where people can find this information. Representative Guerra?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just on the subject of Head Start, we flat-funded Head Start for a number of years, and frankly, I tried an amendment in the Education Finance Subcommittee to add some Head Start funding, and I'd certainly be thrilled if other members were supportive, if we could all speak to other members of the legislature about doing something better than flat funding on Head Start this year.
Go ahead.
Appreciate that, Representative Guerra. You will be hearing from a number of partners around the state on a campaign for early childhood literacy that will begin in the summer, so it will become something that we will be working with you all on. It's very, very critical. I wanted to sort of make sure that as we presented this data that the issues and the concerns and the many, many challenges out there are not all specific only to Alaska's Native people. As Representative Guerra and others have alluded to here, there are issues of poverty, and the same kinds of data that you saw reflected for our population exist across the board. And so the kinds of achievement gaps that we see for Alaska Native kids, FAS issues, inhalants, substance abuse, run across the board for other Alaskan kids. So we didn't want to just make this our concern or our challenge or our problem. It is a huge issue across the board. So we wanted to leave the kinds of questions that we've been talking to communities about with you in terms of making sure that we attempt to get on the same page about what this data means. What about funding? I know you're right in the middle of that debate now, but clearly in the conversations that we've had with the leaders in education, communities, and others, it is an issue, and it does get to the concerns that were raised at the table here this morning about what do we need to do to close that achievement gap? What are the inadequacies? What are the difficulties faced in not only urban Alaska, but certainly rural Alaskan schools too? How can we strengthen the relationships between the many players? How can we use the data to guide what you all are doing? How can we help you with the kinds of information we have available to help you with the tough decisions that you have to make? Again, the importance of early childhood education, leadership involvement, parental participation. We want to make sure that you are aware that that is one of the critical issues that we continue to bring up in communities, is how we get parental and community participation. But recognizing too, and I'm reminded of this every day as we work through this, when that classroom door shuts, school goes on, no matter what's happening anywhere else. So how can we then support the teacher and have that individual do the best he or she can do given the resources that are available to them? In our office, we have 10 people. We have a small staff, but every single day, two of us go to Tyson Elementary School and read. That is one role that we as an organization felt we could do to help the kids that may need the extra help. It's a K-6 school, and we're there every single day, and for them, we are the one constant in their lives that helps them get through the day for the kinds of things they need to know. So that's the kind of message that we're taking out there, is the small things communities can do to begin addressing the issues. But as you can see, they're huge. They're not any one thing that we can put our thumbs on and say this is the answer. And we would appreciate the opportunity to continue to work with you on understanding what are the easy solutions and then to get to the tougher ones as we move forward.
Greta, in the slides, one of the things, and maybe I just don't remember, but it seems to me that we had a lot of comparisons between the study that was done and what the population as a whole, but there wasn't one on drinking. And we know that's the number one in all of Alaska. That's the number one problem, but I don't think that was mentioned.
I'm not sure if I understand your question.
Alcohol use.
Okay.
You know, it's the number one problem in Alaska overall.
That was one of the issues when we brought this information out to the communities that they said they wanted to see more of in terms of We had some information on teenage drinking, for example, but there isn't a lot of information that apparently is either gathered, or if it's gathered, it's not necessarily put into a easily understandable report format for alcohol usage by community or by region or by whatever delineation you want to put out there. But that was something that our community said that they wanted to see and better understand too, because like what I seem to be hearing you say is that if we had a better idea of that, we would better know how to deal with some of the issues that alcohol use and abuse create for our communities.
Because, and I'll follow up on that, because we're number one, Alaska as a whole is number one in alcohol abuse, we're number one in domestic violence, we're number one in suicide. And so, I think that's very, very important for us to try to grab onto that. And any kind of study that's going on, if we can somehow correlate that and try to figure out if there's anything that we can do. So,
yeah. Representative Salmon.
Yes, the question I had is down there at the bottom, reading ways to help your kids, and I noticed they don't have a lunch program on there. How does that affect the students? I know in our school district, like Yukon Flat School District, I mean, they've been cutting lunch programs here recently, you know, so I was kind of wondering how would that affect that?
We, in our work with the Title I schools, where you're talking about in your community, they don't provide lunch?
Well, I think this year they cut that down drastically.
Okay, so that children then have to bring their own lunch to school? Yeah. We know that in the Title I schools that we're working with in Anchorage right now, because that's where we're based, our home office, there are monies, Representative Salmon, available for school lunch programs, and maybe we can talk to you about that so that no school should go without lunch programs for children. Federal programs are available, and I'm sure that that's something that you're talking about with your colleagues here, but I'd like to fill you in on the information that we have on the school lunch programs.
Representative Gatto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm not aware of any schools that don't provide lunch, but I am aware of schools, and almost all of them, that actually are providing breakfast now. Mm-hmm. I think if there's anything we can do to help kids, we ought to at least start actually backing up a little bit and talking to parents. We were talking, you mentioned specifically early childhood education. The state doesn't have it, but we do. We do have kindergarten. We do have, we do feed them. We do have classes for them. What we want them to do is arrive super duper primed, rested, nourished, clothed properly. The trouble is we're finding them arriving. It's winter. They come in without snow pants. And then recess comes, and they say, well, I don't have snow pants. Well, mom and dad have that obligation and responsibility. Or, I'm hungry. Well, go see the nurse. And the nurse has crackers and peanut butter, snacks. Or, I don't feel good, and they have a temperature. And if I were going to be looking somewhere, I don't know what more the state can do. You know that we have X amount of dollars, and every group that we meet is saying, if we had more money, we could do better. I mean, there isn't a group that comes to us and says, you know what I think? I think you're overfunding us. Is there some way you could cut our budget? But they do come and ask for a great deal more, sometimes 50 and 100% more, because they're doing such a good job and simply want more money. And I'm so hopeful, or wishful, I guess, that we can get the parents involved and say, we need some accountability to make them show up. We have truancy problems, but how much can the schools do to take over from the parents before we literally turn them over to the schools and say, listen, call me when they're done with eighth grade and I'll pick them up, because we need you to take care of feeding them, educating them, driving them around, clothing them, taking care of their health needs. Almost completely. It's a worrisome thing that we don't have parents that are certainly more involved than they are. Is there some movement? Or are you seeing that we're tending to move further and further away from parents being involved in their own child's welfare and education?
No, in fact, it's just the opposite. What we see going on, and one of our mantras is going to be healthy communities, what that means, what that looks like. And, you know, you raised a couple of issues. At the school we read at, again, it's a Title I school and high poverty level school. And maybe you should come with us next time we go over there, or next time you're in town. Many families, it's very difficult to watch the families that are unable to provide for their kids, doing the best that they can to provide for them, but they themselves are homeless, living in their cars, and the last thing they can even think about getting without figuring out how to get it from a donation is a pair of snow pants, for example. For many families, it's very difficult. I did want to say, though, that for many other families, there is no question that the larger percentage of families do care about their kids, are taking care of them, do want them to be doing well in school, and it's very unfortunate that our data reflects that there is a huge problem out there, but we don't want to leave the impression that that is the majority of what is going on. However, for the numbers that we have presented, it is creating a huge draw on the resources that are available to try to bring that group of folks up to the level of the rest of them. United Way, for example, and this is something that we've been talking about, how can we work together with all the different groups doing like things that gets to your issue of are we getting the best bang for our buck? How can we work with all the different groups working on a specific issue and begin leveraging, collaborating, and working towards some common goals so that we can see some real headway being made in the work that everybody is trying to do? And for United Way's example, they have taken their approach to working on issues from just raising money to giving out money to really having community impact that results in positive gains for how they're investing their monies. And I think that model is something that all of us would like to work from. But as to your specific question about are we moving away from parental involvement, no. In fact, what we are doing is really turning the road to say it has to come back to wellness in communities, community health, and it must begin at home.
Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Scanlon, I happen to agree with your statement that you made earlier, which is that your statement on early childhood education, and to the extent your organization has any proposals on what we can do feasibly to do better in the early childhood education front, I'd certainly be happy to see them. I personally think, and I oppose the governor on this, I think we made a huge mistake in eliminating the early childhood education program that allowed us to educate four-year-olds in kindergarten. That elimination in 2003, I think even the governor is now seeing, was a mistake, and anything we can do to pressure for a return of that program might be useful. And frankly, we talked about Head Start, so I think there are huge gaps in the early childhood education system in the state, and I happen to agree with the comments that were made in that regard. But any proposals you have, we'd certainly love.
We are one of the planning organizations for a statewide conference right after you guys adjourn. We did it to meet your schedule on May, I believe it's the 16th and 17th. I will double check that. It's with the Humanities Forum, Rasmussen, Siri, the Statewide Library Association, First Alaskans, and a few others. So we are putting together a statewide conference on early childhood education and literacy.
Thank you.
We will make sure you all are invited to that.
Thank you.
And I certainly would recommend, you know, members of this committee to do what they can to try and talk to these ladies. They have a wealth of information beyond this committee. Representative Lynn?
Well, I'm just going to underline the comments by Representative Gatto. I think, quite frankly, the best early childhood education begins at childbirth. Up until the time they do enter the formal system, nothing can replace the parents, because that's kids don't belong to the school system. Kids belong to parents, and I'm not even sure they belong to parents. Maybe they belong to who it is that gives children two parents. So, you know, all these things are good. I support all these things, but we must never take parents out of the equation.
Thank you. Any more questions?
I just wanted to make a comment. There are a lot of schools out there that don't have hot lunches. My schools Yeah. Well, don't have hot lunches.
Hot lunch.
Don't even have lunches. My schools don't have lunches at all, period.
They don't have free and reduced lunch?
We don't have lunches, mm-hmm. period.
All right. Maybe we need to look into this. And with that, I would just like to say thank you to Sarah Scanlon and Greta Gatto with the Alaska Native Policy Center for this very informative overview on education. And with that, this meeting is adjourned.